It is the proclamation of the gospel that changes a heart and reorients it outward from itself. And then that person is the only one who's going to truly help the poor without regard for what they might get back from them. Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, March 11th, 2025. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here as always with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of St. Luke's Anglican Church on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Gentlemen, how are you today?
Doing great, Nick.
Thank you.
J.D., we would be remiss if we didn't celebrate the birth of your seventh child. Congratulations. How are you all adjusting?
We're doing great. Thanks. Yeah, we've sort of got the hang of it by now. So this is little Raglan St. George Coke is his name. We're calling him George, quickly becoming Georgie or Georgie Porgy, all the various diminutives. But he does have one of the coolest stories of St. George and the Dragon that we get to begin celebrating with him. But yes, Laz is doing great. She everyone's healthy and gaining weight and healing up the way they're supposed to. So we're grateful. I think this is, unless someone drops the baby off at our house, this will be the last time we have sort of pursued a child, of our own volition.
We'll include your address in the show notes.
Well, that would be, that would be hard. It's hard to say no when you actually see them, So yeah. in the abstract, it's easier to say no. But yeah, we think this is probably the number of completions. We have five boys, right. We have a basketball team, we have two cheerleaders, a coach, and we have a medic, or I guess that's what Liza would be. we're doing great. Thanks. It was quite a whirlwind weekend between the conference immediately, literally the day after all the people left for the conference. We went into the hospital and it's been a little bit of a blur since then. But praise God, everyone's healthy and whole. So here we are.
Amen. Matt, how do you feel about the Cokes finally eclipsing the Kennedys in terms of number of progeny?
It's been a long play.
I'm happy for you, but man... Maybe we should go adopt some
kids. It's wild. I mean, when I first met you, I thought you were crazy because you had six kids. And now I feel like I've caught the sickness. Like, what's wrong with that guy? So we're excited. We're just welcoming him in. Pray for the youngest. The little ones are having the hardest time, as you can imagine, sort of figuring out what is this living doll that they're not supposed to touch or look at or hit. And so that's right. Don't even point.
He goes to 11.
That's right.
Well, we'll be praying for sure. Congratulations again. So this week we wanted to talk about the initiatives of the ACNA, the provincial initiatives, one in particular, probably the best known one, the Matthew 25 initiative. Its mission is to equip and sustain Anglicans serving alongside the vulnerable. And its vision is to see an Anglican expression of justice and mercy in every parish. Matthew 25 has occasionally been, let's say, mildly controversial, mostly for seeming to advocate that properly caring for the vulnerable involves adopting certain specific political positions. I went to their breakout session at Provincial Assembly and very much enjoyed it. Recently, they hosted a webinar with Archbishop Steve Wood, which both JD and I attended. Each year, they put out a devotional for Lent. So let's talk about Matthew 25 and maybe as we go, talk about the idea of provincial initiatives as a whole. What are your impressions, guys?
I mean, first of all, the name incorporates bad exegesis into the whole thing, because Matthew 25 is, I believe anyway, that they're referring to the sheep and the goats parable that Jesus tells in Jerusalem last week before his crucifixion. And the one classic misreading of that text is that Jesus is saying that to the extent that you help people who are poor, people who are in need, people who are in desperate situations, anytime you do that, you're actually serving me. Now, there's some truth to that. I mean, absolutely. I mean, Christians are always called to help the poor, regardless of faith tradition, regardless of color, creed, all of that. But the parable isn't about that. The parable is about helping the least of these, my brothers. The parable is about Christians serving Christians, and by that service, by that selfless service toward the other, being marked out as sheep, because the world doesn't treat the Christian in dire straits with compassion and love, but Christians do. That's one thing that marks us out. That's one way you can distinguish sheep from goats. So the whole parable is not about just a generalized helping the poor. There are many other passages where you could go for that, but this isn't one of them. And so if my parish were ever going to be involved in a ministry like this, I would have to petition them to rename their organization, because it's bad exegesis. And it's also a text that's been used over and over again, misused over and over again by the left to claim, well, it's not really important that you believe the right things. What's as important is that you do the right things. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
See, these people are all engaging in good works, and it doesn't matter what they believe, but they're going to be on the right hand side of Jesus with the sheep because of their good works. So it's a bad. I mean, just naming an organization like that and having it focused on that kind of work, I'm not judging the motives of anybody, but it does set the organization within a framework of thought about quote unquote social justice that tends to de-emphasize theological orthodoxy and emphasize social "quote unquote" justice.
So, if I'm hearing you right, you don't care about poor people. Is that what I'm?
That's exactly what I was saying.
I just want to make sure I'm steel man your argument just before we No, I agree. I agree with you entirely, and I've seen the same trajectory, and that's why I'm concerned about it. You know, when we listened to the webinar and read some of the white papers and things, and just, you know, have been involved in this conversation now since it began, and one of the difficulties is the oft articulated, in my opinion, false dichotomy between the churches that quote unquote just preach the gospel, and then the ones that engage in the, you know, the restorative work of the gospel, or however it's put often. And, you know, that sounds, it sounds like if a meaningful distinction if it were true. But, you know, here I am having spent, you know, my entire life by God's grace in and out of various churches. I mean, obviously, for the past 25 years, been in the Anglican church. But regardless of whether it was a free church or a vineyard or a Baptist church or a non-denom or an Anglican church, I've never been in a church or heard of a church that has any bifurcation between the quote-unquote preaching of the gospel and then the care of the poor and the downtrodden, you know, in some capacity. Now, obviously, some of these churches had a lot more resources than others and were able to have, like, you know, an actual soup kitchen or, you know, a homeless pantry or something like this. But the ones that didn't still gave to something like that, or still collected money for, you know, still had like a month where they went out. And I remember working with a church once where they had people that went out in the middle of the winter, you know, and found people and put coats and gloves and gave them bowls of soup, you know, in the middle of the winter. And this was just like six people, but the church was probably only, you know, maybe 100 people total. And so, again, I'm not in the least bit wanting to disparage the hope that blooms in a Christian's heart for caring for the poor and needy and the quote unquote least of these. I just think that it's an unnecessary antagonism that is the fruit of a false dichotomy that results in a moral posturing on behalf of the most empathetic, you could say, to use the nomenclature of today, or the most concerned, you know. And you see it, we saw it in seminary, you know, the people who are the most, you know, who protest the loudest about the need for the church to do better, you know, or to be more winsome, more caring, more self-sacrificial, are sort of command a place at the table in the conversation that has the appearance of, you know, spirituality and zeal. And again, I'm not questioning their intent, but it's this false antagonism, that's a result of this false dichotomy that begins to get people's backs up on both sides of the question. And it's just unnecessary. You know, it's like you said about your going to the one at the provincial council, Nick, like the constant sort of just celebration of how in big and small ways Christian churches care for the poor and needy, you know, and they might disagree even on some of the means by which they do this. You know, some people may see the root of homelessness in their particular area as a result of, you know, poor life choices, you could say, and lack of access to to better resources. You know, that could be one way of answering it, or it could be a situation where you really did have some, you know, some sort of, for lack of a better word, systemic or political injustice that needed to be addressed. And so, you know, those are two completely different ways of addressing the same problem, which cannot be mandated from on high, which again is another problem with these provincial wide initiatives, is that, you know, back to the question of subsidiarity, is it like the context, my context, I hate using that language, but it's like I trigger myself. But, you know, in my particular context, everything I'm doing is right and everything you're doing is wrong. That's usually how it's presented. How we deal with these issues on Hilton Head is going to be different than how you deal with them in Binghamton, how you deal with them in Louisville. I mean, that's just, and that seems so self-evident that it would call into question the need for provincial-wide initiatives that would take away resources that could otherwise be used at a diocesan level in specific ways that you would know better than somebody from, you know, from Ambridge or wherever would know.
I want to say something before we get too far afield from the idea of this false dichotomy, which is that not only are these ideas, like, quote, just preaching the gospel and, quote, doing something, i.e. helping the poor, not only are they not antagonists, one actually is the only proper cause of the other. It is the proclamation of the gospel that changes a heart and reorients it outward from itself. And then that person is the only one who's going to truly help the poor without regard for what they might get back from them. They're doing it because they are so beloved in Christ. That's the source of any true mercy.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. That's straight out of Galatians, but also Luther's Defense of the Christian. Yeah. But yeah, and I think that's one problem with emphasizing social justice is you lose the reality that it's all out of thanksgiving for the grace you've been given. The thing, and maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree here, but we just came out of Ash Wednesday. Matthew chapter 6, right? I'm not sure what you guys preached on Ash Wednesday, but
Matthew chapter 6, yeah.
Right? It's a great virtue signaling chapter, right? Like don't if you're gonna fast, but don't make a show out of it. Don't make a feast out of your fasting. And if you're gonna give, but don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Your right hand know what your left hand is doing. One or the other. And it just seems to me like one of the real pitfalls of all of these really public ministries that are focused on social justice is it they just breed that kind of thing.
Well, that's what I was saying about the moral posturing.
Yeah, it just breeds a kind of look at us, look what we're doing. Why aren't you with us? And if you're not doing the kind of things that we're doing, you're wrong. And I think if, especially for Christians who are new, immature, people who just, I think there are a lot of people within the ACNA, just like where there are a lot of people within other denominations that really just don't know the gospel, who haven't heard it, don't understand the law, gospel distinction that you're talking about, Nick. And programs like this attract people like that. I think it offers a relief valve for guilt, a relief valve for having to deal with your own sense of being a sinner. I can join this initiative. I can do all this work. I can give all this money. I can go out in the streets. And so I'm hovering around the thought, but I just wish that if the ACNA is going to do something like this, which I don't necessarily disagree with, I hear what you're saying about subsidiarity and I agree with that totally. But if the ACNA is going to do something like this in a provincial level, could you just do it and not talk about it so much? could it just be a ministry that gives that very quietly goes about its business of doing good work?
Well, to be fair, its business is encouraging Anglican churches to do good work. Like, they're not doing homeless ministries themselves. They're trying to encourage Anglican churches to be doing that sort of thing.
Sure. Could it just do that, though? I mean, because that doesn't come across as encouraging. It comes across as scolding and cajoling.
Well, that's the thing. So when I went to the breakout session at Provincial Assembly, it was basically case studies or story time or whatever you want to call it of 6 or 8 churches who stood up and gave presentations of the wonderful ministries they have at their churches for all sorts of things, whether it was immigrants and refugees or single mothers, or I mean, almost anything you can think of. And Anglican Church is invested in supporting those who have trouble. And that, to me, is Matthew 25 at its best and what it could be, which is a clearinghouse for stories and equipping and encouragement for churches that want to do something and either don't know how to get started or want to do it better or want help or advice or support. They can go to Matthew 25, get connected with a church that's already doing the kind of thing they want to do, and get support in doing it. Unfortunately, it seems like, at least anecdotally from my own experience, it seems like what Matthew 25 is more about, unfortunately, is sort of shaking their heads and wishing we Western Christians were better people.
Right, even though we're part of a church that has continues to be a group of people that are generous, you know, globally and mission-minded, unlike a church that's ever existed, you know, in the history of Christendom. You know, the all those stats about the American, quote-unquote, you know, the evil white evangelicals that still give, you know, over and above all of the forced taxation that's taken from us. We still give tons of money to foreign relief, to World Vision, to mission agencies, to, you know, above and beyond our, as like I said before, our taxation. And it's just, like I said before, it just rings so hollow. You know, I mean, we've been around long enough to really see what happens on the ground level of churches, for large and small. And it's just not the case that I've ever seen spirit-filled believing Christians not care at all, or not even be for actually sort of more than care, like actually a little bit concerned, you know, a little bit nervous about maybe not doing enough, or maybe being somewhat inappropriately, you know, guilty of their own privilege, you know, in a good sense, and want to share it, you know, want to share of their abundance. You know, I mean, I've seen people that need to be motivated in this respect, but it's never, again, it's back to the false dichotomy. And I agree with you, Matt. I think that it's a way of moral posturing that is it's distasteful when you're on the other side of it. Even if you then immediately defend yourself by saying, well, here's the things that I'm doing, but then you find you're using the language of the law. You know, it's like, well, are we fighting here? Like, how did this happen? I just walked in to talk about, you know, what Christians could do to be Christians, and all of a sudden I feel like I have to defend myself in six different ways. And it's so that's part of the sort of the sensitivity I have to it. It doesn't help, perhaps, that we came out of a church that, for all intents and purposes, had abandoned any orthodox proclamation of the gospel, of actual sin and redemption, heaven and hell, and only focused on horizontal, quote unquote, acts of mercy. So, you know, there is a recognition in my own heart that there's a little bit of a echo of that. And anytime I hear it, I get a little nervous. And so that's just something I have to be aware of. That being said, I do think that many of the language used surrounding, particularly when they say the vulnerable and the least of these and the needy, has adopted the kind of oppressor oppressed, sort of morally neutral victim. Like all of these people in these situations are just 100% victims of an unjust society that has broken them, or a system that has been perpetrated against them. And that's a difficult way, you know, to have a conversation and insert things like sin and responsibility and accountability and agency. You know, like, I mean, like, for instance, homeless people. You know, I mean, we have homeless people, you know, the further south it goes, you go, at least, you know, easier it is to live outside. And so even homeless at Hilton Head, there's a number of homeless people, and there's shelters, and there are places that people work for. We have people walk in, you know, probably once or twice a month, just because it's, you know, down near the beach. And so we're not unfamiliar with the problem, but we're not unfamiliar also with the fact that many of these people have gotten into situations on account of sin, not just corporate or systemic, but their own. And so we have to navigate that, you know, because part of the reality of preaching the gospel is actually the law and the gospel, and to sort of hold someone who has gotten themselves in a situation by equal parts, perhaps their own weakness and the weakness of the system that wasn't able to help them get out of it, is complicated, messy, and difficult. And so sometimes it's going to look different, like we said before, in the various contexts. But the fact that there's this implication that unless we are, as good Christian people, sort of exhorted and challenged to do so, we otherwise would just revert to a sort of indifference to the poor and the needy and the least of these. And that's what is offensive at the heart of some of these conversations. Because again, all I sit there saying is like, who are you talking about? I want names and I want parishes and I wanted bishops, you know, because if I have a clergy person in our diocese that's in a leadership position and is advocating open indifference to the poor and the needy in their community, well, then they need to be defrocked, or at least they need to be, you know, they need to be brought up on charges or something, because that's not Christian. So where is this happening? Though that, thank you for exposing this, but then this, but the whole conversation is revolving around this amorphous group of people who evidently don't care. And I just, the whole time I'm saying, who are these people? Like, where are they? You know, let's go find them and, you know, lovingly confront them like Peter did to, what Paul did to Peter. But, you know, that doesn't help, because it turns out, it could turn out that there aren't really that many out there, in which case it might bring into question the need for the entire initiative at all, in which case, you know, that would be a whole different conversation. So I think it's probably easier in a certain sense to keep it. A lot of those people over there, you know who they are, you know, but we want, and so that's just a difficult way to have a way to have a meaningful and constructive conversation.
Taking up what you just said about the universality of sin, I mean, I'm noticing Nick took some notes at the Matthew 25 webinar, and I'm not sure if this is a direct quote or just something, an impression you got, but it's whenever we come near the downtrodden, we come near the presence of the Lord. Yes, I mean, in the sense that everyone's made in God's image. If the downtrodden are Christians, then we definitely, yes, because the person is not only made in God's image, but also has the Holy Spirit living in the person. But both of those things could also be said for Bill Gates or for Elon Musk, or an incredibly wealthy person is also, if by virtue of being human, made in God's image. And if a very wealthy person is a believer, he's indwelt by the Holy Spirit. And so I don't know, this seems like an ennobling of the poor, as if they're, by virtue of their impoverishment, more virtuous than others. And like you say, JD, that's just, if you had actual real contact with people who are homeless, who are in those situations, that's just not true. As Christians, we need to be approaching everybody as someone who bears the image of God, that's been torn and destroyed by sin, ravaged by sin, and who's in desperate need of the gospel. They may also need some food, in which case we give them the food, but we also give them the gospel. When we first started our food kitchen our soup kitchen at Good Shepherd, we were very indiscriminate about who was allowed to volunteer for it, and so I remember going down, it's in our parish hall, and speaking to one of our parishioners at the time, who since left, you know, why are you doing this?
It's like every podcast, Matt tells a story about a parishioner who's left.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm going to do it. I'm going
to
do it again.
You got to preach down to the faithful 100, Matt.
Yeah. Makes me feel good. And it's who this is the kind of person I am.
That's right.
I guarantee you, like, we have programs like Matthew 25 breed that. If you divorce it from the gospel,
wait. Say again what this parishioner of yours said to you.
Oh, he said, well, because this makes me feel really good. This is the kind of person I am. I like to give of myself. This is who I am, and it makes me feel really, really good. So really, there was no sense that I'm here serving Christ, and I want these people to know who Jesus is, and we give them food to feed them and help their bodies. But I also am looking for an opportunity to share the gospel and bring them to the love and knowledge of Jesus. So that's what you want. And a person who's interfacing and working in a soup kitchen, if it's a Christian soup kitchen, or in any kind of quote unquote social justice ministry, you want the primary aim to be, yes, feeding the body, but ultimately introducing the person to Christ. But again, I don't. Did you guys, when you were in the webinar, did you hear that? Was that any part of the emphasis?
No, and in fact, that was, as we said earlier, there was the hint of, we need to move away from the idea that we're just preaching the gospel. We have to do this other thing too. And in fact, speaking of false dichotomies, I did hear this in the webinar, but you all will have heard this in many other places as well. This false dichotomy between the poor and Christians, you'll hear, we're called to serve the poor, but gosh, I spend most of my time with Christians, as though those are two separate categories, and our churches aren't full of poor people to whom we must be ministering.
That's right. Somebody preached once about even being blessed as the poor in spirit. I don't know. It was something I heard once to a congregated mass.
I mean, I think that may have been true in the Episcopal Church. Like, I don't. It's hard to find a really impoverished Episcopal Church. That's maybe easy to find a congregation that doesn't have a lot of money, closing down. But usually, the people in the church are not impoverished. They're usually among the more elite. But in the ACNA, I think it's a different thing. We're in a different animal. I don't think that the Episcopal Church has. So it's not a given that the elites of the city, if they're Christian, are going to rush to the nearest ACNA church. Many of them might still rush to the Episcopal Church or to a more established mainline church. So maybe that's a leftover or a hangover from the days when Anglicanism was paired up or completely with
It does feel like, you know, because the same, again, I'm not speaking, I knew very few of the people involved, so I'm not speaking specifically of any one person, but there was this move in when the Episcopal Church had all these resources by a group of people who saw it as a relatively soft touch for money towards social justice and social action. You know, this was, I mean, I have friends of mine that were priests who were older than we are, who wanted to be a social worker in college. And the advice given to them was, well, you should then become an Episcopal priest because that's where all the money and influence is. So if that's what you want to do, that's where you should go. You know, and this was just said by a matter of course. And so I think, you know, there is that veneer probably still, or at least that misconception in some people's mind that they're sort of looking at this, you know, Scrooge McDuck vault of gold, you know, that could be used to fund any of these now unfunded USAID initiatives, you know, across the world. But, you know, it goes back to something you said, Matt, which just made me think, you know, I wonder in this, it's not just a false dichotomy when people say, quote, just preach the gospel versus helping their physical needs, because it makes me wonder if, you know, how could you actually say that the experience of and the reality of salvation doesn't have immediate, how could you say just eternal? It has eternal, but immediate temporal and effects on your physical well-being, not the least of which you are immediately freed from guilt, shame, and fear. You know, I mean, like you're freed from, you're at least given the tools to begin fighting your self-destructive addictions and habits. You at least begin reordering and rewriting your wrong mindset about important ideas about responsibility and limits to freedom and all these various things that get people into dire physical situations. You know, I mean, like rampant promiscuity or addictive behaviors or, you know, laying down responsibilities or abusing freedoms. Like all of these things are addressed by the Spirit through conversion when you quote unquote just preach the gospel. And so it makes me, it's bothering me more than I thought, is the longer I contemplated that there's this dichotomy at all. You know, it's like our whole conference that we just came through, you know, Romans 12, you know, therefore, in view of God's mercies, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, because this is your spiritual act of worship. So the converse is true as well. Like when your spirit is in the right place, then your body falls in line. You know, so the idea that you could just perpetuate somebody's unbelieving misery by feeding their physical needs without actually addressing what the true root of their physical maladies, which is their spiritual deadness, should be rejected out of hand as a false premise from the beginning. And the fact that it's being allowed to be perpetuated, and then the people being propped up, I mean, I'm even looking at some of these, the contemplative activists, you know, like Dorothy Day is among them and Mother Teresa. And, you know, these are not people that, you know, they did good things and could be lauded in certain respects, but you'd like to see like a William Wilberforce up there, you know, as a good Anglican, you know, someone that labored tirelessly in the halls of power, you know, whining and dining and arguing in deep in the swamp of his day to fight, to make a political change that ultimately was successful. You know, I mean, there are people that are being dismissed as quote unquote Christian nationals left and right who are trying to attempt that as we speak. And yet, what are we upholding but people who were much more conversant with and friendly to active and outright socialists and communists than you might want as a Christian, you know? So again, it's one of these things where I'm grateful that ACNA, you know, we have been winnowed and we have been reset. And so there's a lot of goodwill towards these initiatives, even if we have some concerns with them. And the people, you know, have sacrificed, many of them have sacrificed a lot to be a part of the ACNA. And so I'm not disparaging anyone in particular, but, you know, there is too much history, both within the mainline church, but also just in the Western church, to not at least be concerned about the language, about the emphases, about the de-emphasis in some areas, about the false dichotomies, and frankly, about the tenor of it, for lack of a better word, like we've been talking about, the sort of the growing sense of kind of sort of congratulatory smugness, which, again, I'm not pointing to anyone particular, but the general conversation begins to take that shape. And you find otherwise hardworking, you know, head down, relatively small parish priests finding themselves in a defensive posture over against their colleagues and even the province for that matter, when they're not putting into place programs that look sufficiently compassionate or sufficiently self-sacrificing. And I just feel for them. I feel for the people who have yet another thing to worry about. They're not doing well enough, you know, as a parish priest and, you know, storefront in Ohio somewhere. And it's like, look, we're doing the best we can. Can you pray for us? And you know, we'll trying to do the Lord's work here. And that's who I really feel for, you know, the most when it comes to these conversations.
Well, you know, it's not just, I mean, this is the Matthew 25 initiative is what we're basically focusing on right now. But I think at least most of the problems you mentioned that are there with this particular initiative, you can see them in the other provincial initiatives as well. I mean, the next, go read, for example, any online material about the Next Gen initiative, which is intended to pass on Christianity and Anglicanism to the next generation of leaders, raise up new leaders. But look at the material, and I think you said it offline, but it's like, you know, 2019 called and they want their woke back. it's the same. All of them have that same kind of tenor. And you know, I love Archbishop Foley Beach. He was a great Archbishop and a good man and wonderful leader. I think these initiatives came into play under him. I'm not sure if he introduced them, but they very quickly went woke, and they still are. And so I hope this Archbishop will not just hand them over to representatives of one particular diocese in our province, but be sure that they're being overseen theologically.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see, again, and I don't have any reason to think they haven't been successful. I just don't, I haven't, I don't know if they have been, and I don't know what the sort of, you know, deliverable metric could be to say that we have, you know, like the planting churches one, you know, I mean, I think there's been some real concern about the speed towards planting churches, particularly as we see, back to your point, Matt, you know, some of them were, we should say, not as formed, fully formed theologically as we'd hoped, you know, that, you know, like the next generation leadership initiative. Again, I'm not disparaging any one of these in particular, but from my perspective, you know, the more I sort of embrace sort of the Anglican witness over against alternative church bodies, as the Missouri Synod would say, is that one of the things that we have going for us is not only, you know, more than 500, it's only 500 reformed, but, you know, we have ancient practices which are intended to form healthy families and then by extension communities that are multi-generational and by extension attractive to young people, to, you know, unmarried people who are looking up at the parents and grandparents who are all worshiping, you know, raising their children together in the same place, worshiping in one voice, and actually offering an alternative witness to the world in all these capacities. You know, I mean, I know for a fact in our church, if one of our church members had, and this happens very frequently, falls on hard times or has a unforeseen medical expense or loses their job or something, like we have, not only do we have funds, but we have individuals who immediately have stepped up in every single instance.
Absolutely.
You know, we have young people, you know, the young people come to our church and they say, They asked me, how can why do you have so many children? Or they asked the married people, like, how can you possibly get married in this climate? How did you afford this? How do you, this is how and where these type of ministries take place is through the interaction of the people of God in the house of God for the sake of the local community. And so again, it's not that we don't have a provincial leadership and we don't have sort of generalized directives, but it's just that being so far removed from the particular context, and then given the necessity for how different each one would be, I don't see how these conversations could go anywhere but kind of patronizing or at the very least dismissive of people not doing it in a particular way, because you can't, from one provincial perspective, sort of take into account every single contingency across the board. But that's who asked you to do that, so the general sort of situation could be like, here are five bullet points for the marks of a healthy church or something, for instance, if you wanted to go that way. And you could say, seeks for the engaging the next generation, we could take all of them and put them into active bullet points and basically do away with all the rest of it. And in most churches should be able to say, yeah, like, we're on it, we're looking for it, we're working towards that, thank you very much. But they didn't ask me, so.
I mean, I guess the good news, if you call it good, is that, and I said this during our live show the other day, was that we're a confederacy and not a communion, really. I mean, I wish we were a communion, but I would like to be a communion when we can all have shared values and common understanding of what orthodoxy is. But short of that, I'm glad for the confederacy where Next Gen or Matthew 25 can't be imposed on my parish or on my or even into my diocese without our bishop's agreement. And it's kind of odd on the one hand to have a provincial office having all these initiatives and province-wide ministries, and then on the other hand, it all depends on whether or not a bishop in a given diocese wants to work with you or not. And so you provincial level, your hands are kind of tied unless you can construct programs that are going to be fit for all your dioceses. And you're just not going to be able to do that in our present state.
Well, and I do think most of them are sort of virtually conceived of anyway, right? I don't think, I mean, I've walked past the provincial office in Ambridge many times, and I don't think there's like a,
Huge.
like a hub of
CIA global
activity.
thunder.
That's right. That's right. Everyone's moving. Housing prices in Ambridge have tripled since Stacey Nay's headquarters have moved there. But I do think it's worth saying again, and I think this did come across in the spirit of the conversation, having been subjected to scolding type conversations like this for most of the first, at least the first 12 years of ordained ministry. I have to say that the spirit of it and the tenor and and for the most part the content was largely unoffensive. It just was, I felt like I was on a defensive posture the whole time, because of the vocabulary, what we've heard, what we've seen, and what we frankly, are worried about. And so, I think it's worth talking about. I think, we're having conversations. We're in a, as we said last week in our thing, as part of families make decisions and grow together and have these conversations, hopefully with a spirit of love and charity and mercy, which I, which we have for these, because I do hope that we avoid some of the pitfalls that is associated with this dichotomy that we're rejecting. But at the same time, I hope that we can live into the reality of sharing with the least of these out of the abundance that the Lord has given many of us. And so, I think that it's a worthy thing to be concerned about and aware of, but obviously, it's also a worthy pursuit. And so I think that's just where, at least where I find myself landed after thinking about the past year with the provincial council and then the new archbishop and then his remarks at this initiative gathering. I think, I find myself a little less defensive, but no less ultimately concerned. And so I think that's just, we'll keep an eye on it and talk about it as we feel led.
Fair enough. Good words to end on. If we're going to have provincial initiatives, we want them to serve the province well. Thanks to our listener for joining us on Stand Firm this week. If you want to keep the conversation going, be in touch with us. You can rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com. Follow us on social media. Join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks, as always, to J.D. Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, will be standing firm.